Approaching on a 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. On at 15 seconds, guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Grant Cameron, and I have a presentation I wanted to do with a disclosure update. A couple of items that have sort of come up in the last couple of days. Thought about them a bit and figured I would stick them down on a presentation. Hopefully you'll learn or be entertained by this. I wrote a book called The Canadian Government UFO Story. In that book, which was just released a few months ago, I talked about the work of Wilbert Brockhaus Smith, who ran the Canadian government UFO program from 1950 to 1954 for the Department of Transport. And most famously, he was the person who penned the famous top secret memo, where he went to the United States and came back and found out from American officials the matter of UFOs is the most highly classified subject in the U.S., rated higher than the H-bomb. The other thing that he came up with was flying saucers exist, and he was also told their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who was sort of the scientific czar of World War II technology. And number four, he was basically told the entire matter is considered by the U.S. authorities to be of tremendous significance. And then one that applies to today's topic, the idea of mental phenomena. There were several other things, including mental phenomena, that were being studied because of their possible link to the saucers. And they said if the Canadians were working on it, the Americans were willing to exchange credentials and talk to the Canadians on the subject of mental phenomena regarding UFOs. So now I've done some what we call access to information requests in Canada. In the United States, they're called freedom of information requests. I filed with a number of different departments based upon a story that they were leaking UFO material, which I already knew, to at least one researcher in Canada. And I just received a couple days back 160 pages of material from Transport Canada, which is the old Department of Transport that Wilbur Smith worked for and did the flying saucer investigation. Now, I understand that Vice got 500 pages, the magazine in the States. I think they got it from Defense. So I will get that because I've also filed with the Defense Department. But 160 pages, and basically it's a bunch of lights in the sky UFO sightings. Here's one here, NORAD advised they observed an unknown target. Moving southwest at 75 knots, no impact to operations. And these are filed, and so it didn't really mean too much to me. But then another event happened in Canada, which was a little more significant. And that was that I was contacted a couple of years back by a business associate of mine who wanted me to provide material to an MP who was in the opposition party and regarding UFOs. And so I provided all the Wilbur Smith material from the 1950s. And this sort of conversation started with these people inside the government. Most of the work was done by Dave Scott from Spaced Out Radio, which is a seven night a week radio show run out of BC, which is fairly well listened to, where he talks about paranormal and extraterrestrials, ufology, conspiracy, and all sorts of other bizarre topics. Now, Dave got in contact with these parliamentary people, and he has done more work. He wanted to get this thing out and actually gone to the government to try to get somebody in the government to talk. And the same people that asked me for the files a couple of years back started talking to him. So he's been done most of this work. I just sort of sat on the sidelines and sort of gave information to these people as to who was who, what was important, who people should talk to. And these guys were doing basically a UFO investigation inside the Canadian government. Now they have, one of them has gone public, and that's why I'm going public now a bit with my involvement in this and what actually happened. The guy that's gone public is Larry McGuire, who is, he's a conservative member of parliament from the Brandon Sears constituency, which is in the same province I'm in. I'm in Manitoba. He's in the southwest corner of the province. And he is on the standing committee on natural resources. So to sort of understand how this game is played, it's a little bit different than American politics. We have, first of all, to point out, we have ministers and then deputy ministers. So when Wilbert Smith wrote his memo asking for funds for a UFO investigation in November of 1950, he sent it to the deputy minister of the Department of Transport. Now, the deputy minister usually is more powerful than the minister because the deputy minister is around for many, many years. And the minister is a member of the government. So what happens is that if the person loses their seat, well, then they have to appoint the next guy that comes in will be the new minister. And from time to time, the government will get in trouble. And usually what they do when they get in trouble is they start to shuffle, they do a cabinet shuffle. So they move people from one constituency or one department to another. And so you may be, as Paul Hellyer was, he was Minister of National Defense, and he was the Minister of Transport, Department of Transport. You can get juggled around, but the deputy minister is usually there, so he's the more powerful guy. Now, he's the shadow minister, which means he's not the minister. So we have two different parties. The way it works in Canada is that we have a parliamentary system like the British, where you have the opposition on one side of the house and you have the people in power on the other side of the house, and they sort of yell back and forth across the aisle at each other. And what you basically have is the minister will come from the government side, and you have a shadow minister. So for every cabinet position, say for the Department of Defense, you'll have a shadow cabinet minister on the other side who's like the defense critic. And he will sort of be the guy who asks all the questions of defense and deals with that. So McGuire is a sort of a shadow figure for natural resources. Now, here's what happened. He's on the Standing Committee for Natural Resources. And it was on that committee on March the 3rd, I believe, that he decided that he was going to ask a question of the deputy minister. That is the guy that's appointed by the Prime Minister Trudeau and sits on the government side. So here's the question that he sort of worked. He said, there are some funds being put forward from the Department of Defense to various organizations in the Canadian Safety and Security Program. So in January, the Swedish Security Program Service announced an investigation of drones at all three of their nuclear power plants. So you can see that Larry has done some research. He knows what's going on in the world. He knows about this fact that there are these UFO sightings, which are being called drones, at Swedish security programs, and he brings this up. And then he refers back to historic stuff in Canada. They have also been reported reports over the years of other unknown drone type flying objects flying over Canadian nuclear facilities. So he sets this whole thing up. In the security we're in today, it's been recently announced in the United States legislation has just passed in the National Defense Authorization Act for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to report, quote, the number of incidents and descriptions thereof of unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs, or drones of unknown origin in association with nuclear power generation stations, nuclear fuel storage sites, or facilities regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So I'm just wondering, he says, if any of these of the department officials are aware of the legislation that was just passed in the United States Congress regarding these specific clauses. So this is the famous thing that all the UFO people were waiting for, was the Gillibrand Amendment, when they the Congress basically told all the departments in the U.S. government that they had to report what they knew about UFOs. This is what he's making a reference to. Are you aware of what they've done down in the United States? Now, the guy that answers the question is John Hannaford. Now, he was appointed the Deputy Minister of National Resources for Canada by the Prime Minister in January of 2022. So he's only been in the position for about a month, but he is the actual Minister of Natural Resources, and this is a committee on natural resources where this question is asked. So he replies to McGuire, "Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the question. I must admit I am not familiar with that. I can say, however, that the overall security of our nuclear facilities is obviously something that's of extraordinary importance, including through the regulatory function." So McGuire says, "Thanks. I'll send you the information. Yeah, we've made it we'll make it available to you. Have you received reports on these drones or unidentified aerial phenomena near Canadian nuclear facilities?" And Hannaford says, "I have not." So McGuire then says, "So I guess, can you ask your officials to inquire and report back to the committee in writing anything they know about them?" So Hannaford says, "We can do so, okay." And McGuire says, "Thank you. And are reports of violations reported in and around nuclear facilities publicly disclosed?" Hannaford says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, perhaps I could turn to one of my colleagues who is more directly responsible for the nuclear part." And he mentions Molly Johnson. "She may have more detailed information with respect to that question." Molly, and he goes to Molly, and she comes on the screen, and she answers the question. "Thanks for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would say that security is of course importance, one of the top priorities, and we're considering nuclear. Then we can check and confirm on the drone issue specifically and reporting that's available and get back to you." So she says she's going to look into this. So McGuire does this sort of a weird sort of rant where he's talking about partners of the United States to better assess the nature and extent of unidentified aerial phenomena. "I believe it will be prudent for the Atomic Energy of Canada to proactively reach out to their American counterparts to discuss this legislation and to inquire how they are handling these reports and investigations." And then the important part, which I'll mention in a second, he says, "Would you be open to reaching out to the new American Nuclear Regulatory Commission to start this important conversation?" So Hannaford says, we certainly will take that under advisement," which says, "We won't comment, but we'll investigate, and we'll comment after we've done an investigation." Now, this whole idea about reaching out to the Americans is this concept that an investigation was done by the opposition party here in Canada. They talked to a bunch of people. They talked to Elizondo, Putoff. There was an ambassador. They knew that an ambassador had been briefed, and they did this investigation of UFO material. And then they're talking about handing this material over to the Americans, and yet the Canadians aren't going to know. And this is how this ties into this part we're talking about at the end here, where I talked to one of the aides that was working for Larry McGuire, and here's what I was told. "My hope is that I might have some better questions to ask him." I believe they're talking about Elizondo, "in a couple of weeks. My focus for the time being is trying to see if there is a government apparatus set up in Canada to review and share information internally and among our allies. I don't know how tightly held or the classification of whatever office, quote unquote, is set up. In Canada, we don't traditionally call internal government operations as a program, so there won't be anything that looks like ATIP, nor does Parliament approve funding the same way as Congress. So I suspect that if something does exist, it's squirreled away. We also don't have the same committee oversight or investigative abilities as Congress. Hence is why we have to use much different means to see what's there. Now, here's the key part. I don't rule out the chance that it's all run out of NORAD and we're going to hit a brick wall. Anything we do, something formally with another country, that information is classified and it will never be released or shared. So the question is, why is Larry Maguire asking to share material with the United States? Because that would appear to link it in or lock it in that it can never be released or shared once it's shared with the Americans. So this sort of ends the first part of this disclosure thing. Basically, I'm saying that we really don't know what the Canadian government knows, but we do know that there was an investigation done on UFOs by the opposition party members. They used taxpayer money, and I would request that all of them make public what they have found out. They've had meetings with American people, they've asked questions, and they've done a lot of work. I helped them, and I will start to release my material as to my involvement in this whole thing. It doesn't make any sense to me that we're going to try to score political points with the government in terms of trying to embarrass them about UFOs if we are the ones that ran the UFO investigation and we're not willing to release what we have. So we do know for a fact there was a government investigation by the opposition party, and so far they have not released anything except to ask this question in a committee meeting in Ottawa, which is the nation's capital. Now, second part I wanted to talk about is an interview that Jim Semivan had just done, which I found very, very interesting. I think Jim Semivan is one of the key people that people should watch. I've always said there are people who know more than you and I. I even talked about this, I think, my first book, 1990, where we talked about the Avery, and the fact that there are various people who are talking to each other who have some sort of in, whether it's something they worked on or something they heard, and they talk to each other, but they really don't talk to the public. But certain people, and Jim Semivan is one, Hal Putoff's another, Kit Green, all these people, John Alexander, people who may know more than you and I, and that you may agree or disagree with these people, but you should listen carefully to what they're saying. So Jim Semivan, I was the first to identify Jim Semivan. I mentioned him in a book in February of 2017. And I knew because I was talking to two people who were talking to Jim Semivan in 2016. He's an extremely important person. And he's also an experiencer, which is the very important part of this whole thing. He knows from personal experience that this thing is for real. And he is a key to the disclosure thing. I think people should listen to him. So he's made an interview, said something that kind of surprised me. But in 2016, I was basically told that the fact that they were going to move this thing out. This is a year before Tom DeLonge went public with TTSA, before the films, before the New York Times article. A year before that, I was told clearly what exactly was going to happen, and it all happened exactly the way. There was just a delay in it because Hillary Clinton lost the election. And Jim Semivan was a key part of this whole thing, which ties into what I'm going to talk about here. Now, he wrote a foreword to one of Tom DeLonge's books, and he talks about his involvement in the UFO phenomena. And he said, "My own fascination with the phenomena started in earnest while I was an undergraduate and then later a graduate student majoring in English literature and American Romanticism. Reading the visionary and mystical poetry of William Blake and the transcendental musings of another American romantics fueled my interest in the other." Now, if you know the TTSA, that's when they started using this term, the others, rather than aliens or ETs or anything like that, they were called the others. It was only a short leap for me to the works of 17th century Swedish mystic Emanuel Swedenborg. And then he mentions who knew that Emerson had so many of Swedenborg's works in his library. And then Jim Semivan mentions his study of Christian mysticism, mystery schools, and then onward to the vast literature of metaphysical literature. Those on the journey recognize the path. As for my formal introduction to the phenomena as we know it in today's context, it came suddenly and unexpectedly. So he had this background in reading mystical literature and these sort of things, and then he has his experience. And in these latest interviews, he has started to talk. I had heard about his experience. I had heard the, you know, some of the details, and he's starting to sort of go public with what actually happened to him in the early 1990s with him and his wife, with an encounter with the beings inside the room, which is extremely important. If you have the beings in your bedroom, you may know a little bit more than somebody else, and you've got a vested interest in what's going on. So he talks about this whole thing and his experience. And in an interview with Aliens and Artists, he makes a statement where he basically talks about the fact that he really he doesn't really know whether this phenomena is good or bad based upon his experience. I know he had on four occasions to Melinda Leslie had said he did not think it was a threat. Clearly he said he did not think it was a threat. Actually thought at one point that they really didn't care about us and this sort of thing. But on this interview, he actually makes a statement which he talked about the fact that he really wasn't too sure whether the phenomena was good. He was very upset about his experience after he learned what it was. So I'm a person who says that in order to understand the UFO phenomena, you have to talk to the experiencers. Forget all the rest of the nonsense. You talk to the experiencers, the ones that are dealing with the others. There are people who are claiming contacts, the same as there are people who are claiming they're jet fighter, people who saw UFOs, or people on the street, or people who have sightings, or whatever. The encounter people are the closest to the actual intelligence. Now, if we take a look, and this is something that's always interested me, is this whole thing, and people bring it up all the time, is the abduction phenomena good or bad? Are the aliens good or bad? And I've been very interested because that's a big part of the experiencer phenomena, that you would really have to talk to the experiencers who are actually have the closest contact. There was a survey that was done, Edgar Mitchell and Ray Hernandez, and a bunch of other people did a survey of 3,200 experiencers. This is the only scientific data we have as to the patterns that are involved with experiencers. And what they found out, there was 9% of the people who had the experiences considered the encounter very bad news. Like, evil, this is really bad, what happened to me? And Ray Hernandez actually went back and interviewed a lot of these people in this 9% category and asked them, why did you put them in that category? And basically said, most of them said they were scared to death. They absolutely scared the living daylights out of them. And he said, that was it, that's it. So basically you have 9%. So this idea that the aliens are bad, or whoever they are, the others are bad, is very, very minor. If you actually poll the people who are involved, rather than using rational analytical guessing games or whatever, if you actually talk to the people, not only 9% will say it was bad, and most of those people will say it was bad because they were very scared in this, in what happened. 83% of the people that were polled actually said if they had a chance to stop the experiences, they wouldn't stop the experiences. So you basically have this very high percentage of people who think that this is an enlightening thing, that this is something they want to happen, that they feel chosen or whatever the thing is, see it as positive. Only 9% see it as negative. Now, as for myself, I had my own experience. In 1975, I had my first sighting. We had a bunch of sightings in this flap that was going on, and it was like simply like a circus. It was like unbelievable. We were chasing this thing around. It was really great. And then in 1976, in a town 11 miles away from the main town in Sperling, Manitoba, I had this thing scare the living daylights out of me. It came and sat right on top of the car. It was the most terrifying experience of my life at that point. So to say, I can understand what these people are going through when suddenly you have a being in your room, it can be nothing less than absolutely horrifying to be in that kind of experience. So I can understand because I've had the experience. I've also had 5 experiences since then, which aren't UFO related, but I would take 2 of those experiences and put them up against any experience that anybody has ever described in terms of what we'd call a hellish experience. It was unbelievable. believable. So I'm not talking as a rational, analytical person looking in from the outside. I have had these very bad experiences. And so I've been fascinated with them and to try to figure out why are they happening, why are they being interpreted this way, or what's actually going on. But you have to talk to the experiences in order to understand what's going on. You can't stand on the outside and rationally analyze this thing without talking to people who are actually involved. Now, what Jim's talked about, they were talking this thing about sovereignty. And this is a quote from Jim. He said, "I still retain, and I'm not sure if this is good or bad, I still retain a degree of anger about it, about this experience in the early 1990s. It is an anger in the sense that I wasn't asked. I didn't sign up for this. And I know some people will say in another lifetime, you may have done that. That may be the case. I don't know. As far as I know, the contract has changed. I didn't want this to happen. I certainly did not want this to happen to my wife. It did take a toll on her. Now, I can say in 1976, I did not ask for this UFO to come and scare the living daylights and he sit above the car. And whatever happened at that point, I don't know what happened. There was a break. There was some sort of break with reality when that experience happened. I didn't ask for it either. So I can understand this idea. And it comes to this whole idea, is there this soul contract? Is there this idea? So I've asked a number of people. I've gone down the route and I've tried to actually answer the question. Now, I would say, first of all, Jim talks about this soul contract being made in your last lifetime. Well, I would say in your last lifetime, you're just as asleep as you are in this lifetime. You wouldn't be making the contract in your last lifetime. If you study Dr. Michael Newton, you will see that the concept comes that we plan between lives. That's when we make the soul contracts. That's when we get together with people and we say, okay, we're going to go make this play and you're going to play this and I'm going to play that. And you're going to be this actor and I'm going to be this actor. And it comes to this whole idea, remember who you actually are. You are a soul that has come into the world to play a role. You are not the actual player on the stage. You are just playing an actor on a stage. So I asked Mary Rodwell and I asked Sarah Cosme, who's done QHHT. She's a level 3 QHHT, done a lot of hypnosis. Dolores Cannon, who invented the QHHT, who's written dozens of books on this whole subject. Desta Barnaby is my assistant, who's done a lot of regression. And I asked all of them, basically, is this soul contract? Are people randomly being grabbed off the street? Or is this a soul contract? Are people agreeing? And basically, the answer that comes back is, yeah, like 100%. Yeah, it's absolutely soul contract. That this thing goes over many lives. We don't just live one lifetime. If there's only one lifetime, then everything changes. Yeah, then you can say, oh, it's a random world. And, you know, I just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the more we look at the evidence in terms of UFOs, the more we see this reincarnation thing, where 25% of all experiences are talked to about reincarnation. This is a big factor. And if that is true, everything's going to change. If there are multiple lives, and that was something that was actually given to me in an intuitive download. If it's multiple lives, everything changes. All the rules change. I actually asked Kathy Martin, who was the niece of Betty Hill, and I asked her, Kathy, what do you think about this soul contract thing? She said, I used to wonder about it too. So she said, I actually had myself regressed and I went back and I actually heard the words come out of my mouth. I agree to this. So this is a concept that has to be considered here, is this whole idea of whether it's, we are playing a role or whether we're victims in this world. And what you'll see in these things, even with Jim's, you'll see I and me being used 10 different times where he's talking about this. Now, in terms of the scary thing, Jim Sinavan is not the only guy that's had this experience. And he even in this interview actually talks about his friend, Chris Bledsoe, who is a good friend of mine. And he talks about Chris Bledsoe's was harrowing. I mean, Jim Semivan's experience was nothing like Chris Bledsoe's. In terms of Chris Bledsoe is still suffering. His kid, his oldest son was terrorized. The whole thing, it was horrible. But Chris sees it from a completely different perspective than Jim did in this interview. And here's he's talking to him. He knew about Chris. He, he's close friends with Chris, as far as what Chris is done. And that was one of the people that I was talking to about what was going on in 2016 was Chris Bledsoe, because he's a friend of mine. Now, if you take a look at the soul contract idea, we have to look at what is the evidence. So we can say we really don't know, or we don't believe in soul contract or whatever, but Chris Bledsoe was regressed by Michael O'Connor, who was an associate of John Mack in 2008. Chris had his awakening experience in 2007. In 2008, he was regressed because he was absolutely sitting in a room. He had these headaches. He couldn't get rid of the headaches. He was basically praying for God to take him away. He could not believe his life had come apart at the seams. His wife said, "You are not going to talk about the kids." His oldest son was absolutely terrorized. He locked himself in his bedroom. It was a horrible experience. So he has the regression experience. And during the regression experience, Chris says this: "They were with me before I was born. They take care of certain people. In my mind all along, I just didn't know it." So Michael asks him, the regressionist asks him, "They've been here since before you were born? Were they with you in another lifetime?" And Chris says, "Yes, before I was born, I didn't have to speak to talk to them." So here we have the thing. So the question is, if Chris is telling the truth, if he's getting actual information, that is the pattern. Why would the pattern be different for other people who are abducted? Why is Chris the only one that they're talking to before he was born? You see this pattern where people are talking about the fact that they were with, even John Mack has one case where he talks about the guy. "When was the first time you saw this guy?" And the guy said, "I saw him in my last lifetime." And this is this whole idea that it's much more complex than just aliens coming and grabbing people off the street. There is this concept. And Chris Bledsoe has it in regression. And I would say that you start to talk the experiences, they'll all talk about this whole idea. They're lifers. It's been going on their entire life. And they're on some sort of mission. They've come in here. This is nothing random. And here again, Jim's talking about this whole thing. So there's that, and sort of stuff. And so the question I would ask then, well, hang on. This is like Chris's situation where, we had the incident with the tree, and his son, Chris Jr., who had great troubles with what had happened to him. He was only 17 when this happened. So it was a very traumatic type experience. And yet what you see from that, you say, well, this is terrible. It was his life came apart. And yet you see here he is with Elizondo, and you see Tom DeLonge. Tom DeLonge was actually going to do his story. So the story is very terrifying, and it's whatever, but it's eventually going to be made into a movie. And here's two scriptwriters from Hollywood who came. They did the Conjuring 1 and 2, which did $1 billion. They wrote the scripts, and they were working on Chris's, and came down to Chris controlling the end of the movie, that he didn't want them to change the end of the movie. But from what I had heard, that this was wanted in Hollywood, that Mel Gibson wanted this story. He even proposed he was going to play Chris Bledsoe in the movie. So we have this different aspect that this is for Chris. This turned after the regression. Before the regression, it was a very traumatizing time for Chris Bledsoe. But after the regression, he suddenly realized what was actually going on, and everything started to change. And then it was this idea that he had this message, and he even had an encounter with what he calls like the Lady of Light, 2012, on two different occasions. And that's when she says to him, Chris, you have a burden, and it is yours to carry. And I said to Chris, I said, what is the burden? He said, it's the message. I am here to deliver a message for the lady. And so you have this different aspect of one being victimized, people being victimized, the attitude of woe is me, I was taken against my will, and this sort of thing. And then people who have gone through these regressions, and it's known through the free survey that the more people deal with it, the longer they go on after the first initial encounter, which is very terrorizing, very harrowing, the more they turn into like these missionary type people who believe they're on a mission, and they have a very important story to tell, and they're out there trying to move the story, realizing that it's not what they first thought it was. Even Camp David, Chris Bledsoe's story was, according to some rumors, briefed to the President of the United States. So you have this other aspect that Chris Bledsoe sees the thing entirely different than this idea that I wasn't chosen. He says, yes, I was chosen. When he had the regression, he actually started to believe he actually was chosen for this. Here's another one. I've interviewed Sherry Wilde a number of times on YouTube, and I think she's got a very important story. Here was a woman who actually was suicidal over this whole thing for many, many years. very traumatized by this whole thing, did not want to be public, had a one of her family members get in a court injunction to stop this book from being published. And she basically at one point was trying to tell the beings, leave me alone, I didn't want to do this. And that's when the being, the main being that she was dealing with, whose name was Da, said, Sherry, have you forgotten the promise that you made? And that's why the book is called The Forgotten Promise. She too now is saying, yeah, she agreed to do the message. And hers is going to be a series in Hollywood. They're working on this as well. So she's gone from this sort of victim, although she still doesn't really like the what's going on. She's still not happy with this. And she even told a story, which I made her tell a couple of times, where after the book came out, she's driving and then suddenly this 3D holographic screen appears sort of in the car, and she's seeing this and she's saying, what are you doing? I'm driving. I can't watch the screen or whatever. He said, what is this? And they said, it's the first scene to your movie. And so this idea that the beings have these people who have had these experiences and they want this message out. So here's another person, The Forgotten Promise. She basically was reminded that she had made a soul contract, that she had made an agreement to do this. Now, my own one is this idea that a lot of the things that I see back in my story, this is the Charlie Red Star story, that was the story of how things happened for me in 1975, basically came to the same thing, that I started to realize that this was not a random event. There was absolutely no way when they got this film, which was like the Nimitz film, except it was shot the other way, going from the ground up, and it was actually caught by a TV crew in Winnipeg. It was caught on film, and I interviewed all the people on that film crew and how that thing happened. And when I saw that, I knew this was not a random event. This was intended to get me to go out there and see this thing. And my life flipped upside down, and it has not been an easy life because this has been sort of my life. But it has given me sort of an evaluation that life is a bit more complex than just nuts and bolts and random things happening out of nowhere. Now, again, here's Jim talking about it, about being very angry. I looked at it as a human rights violation. Then I was sort of tempered. It didn't hit me. It didn't make any major changes in my life like most abduction experiences do. And that's what I'm referring to with Sherry Wilde and Chris Bledsoe, where people's lives are completely changed. And I was, I'm going to point out, Jim's life was completely changed as well. People after a few years change the way they view life. I have always had the same outlook. I have always been reasonably spiritual. It didn't give me any knowledge except for this particular incident and what it may mean. It certainly got me talking about it, which is how I'm going to end this thing. It certainly got Jim Semivan talking about it, which was probably what exactly was intended. So I'm saying, who's speaking? So we say, I didn't do this, I didn't, you know, this, and I, and that, me, and whatever. Who is the I speaking? Is it the ego, or is it the higher self? And this comes down to all spiritual literature will come to the basic bottom line. Remember who you actually are. Are you the person that's on here who actually is being abducted, or are you offset and you're playing this role, that this is all a role, this is all, is the higher self being oppressed? Is the higher self being tortured? And basically when you have, we go into our ego states and we start talking about me and I and all this sort of stuff. And the ego is the one that is doing this talking. Who are we really? We are not the actor on the stage. We are playing an actor on the stage. All the world's a stage. All the men, women, aliens, and angels are but actors. They have their entrances and exits, and each man plays many roles. And so we're going to get in this situation that after we die, we suddenly realize, oh my God, it was just a play. We were actually just in a play. And then somebody's going to walk up and say, hey, Grant, you get the Academy Award. You actually believed it was actually going on. You actually believed you were Grant. And this is the whole idea. Remember who you actually are. We are off playing this role. And we're going to do this one and we're going to go into the next one. Whitley Strieber tells the story that I keep repeating, that he got a message from Anne after she died. And Anne said to him, Whitley, I am no longer Anne, but I'll always be Anne to you. she has left the world. And they both played this play on the stage where he was Whitley and she was Anne. But she's basically saying, I'm off doing another character, but I'll always be the Anne that played in the role in the character in the stage play with you. Now, this is something I posted a couple weeks ago on Facebook, and I didn't really watch the reaction, but I got a lot of comments, hundreds of comments. And this comes to this idea, can I become spiritually enlightened without suffering? And people, I guess, had both views. I really didn't look at it, but it was a key question, is this idea that we're suffering. So contact the experiencer people. When they first have the first experience, it is a very suffering type experience. It's very harrowing, as mine was in 1976. You don't know which end is up, and you don't think you really asked for this, and this sort of stuff. So the whole idea is this spiritual enlightenment. Can you do it? Now, what I would give reference to, well, let me first say what this is. Eckhart Tolle, who talks about this, and he maintains absolutely you cannot be spiritually enlightened unless you go through suffering. What I'm really saying is that whatever arises in your life is your practice. It is a practice designed for you. Now, I'm about to do an interview in a couple of days with Ingrid Hunkala, who is a PhD oceanographer who worked for NASA and for the Navy. And the way she expressed it was, things don't happen for us. The things happen for us, not to us. And she had a near-death experience where she describes what happens as a near-death experience. And she maintains the same thing, where these things happen for a reason. And so Eckhart says, it is your spiritual path, particularly the challenges. It is important to see that, the importance of challenges, difficulties, or so-called problems in your evolutionary path. There is the absolute importance of that. It is important to see that so that in your mind, you no longer have the implicit assumption that these things should not be happening. They are happening. It does not mean they should not be happening. Only the mind can formulate that belief that something that is happening should not be happening. The entire history of the universe since the Big Bang, if there ever was a Big Bang, has conspired to bring about the form that this moment takes for you. It's all connected. It comes out of this vastness of the universe. If it looks bad or undesirable, the quickest way to resolve it is by coming to alignment with the present moment so you don't fight it. That is the absolute number one rule, especially when you come to near-death experiences or to psychedelics. Surrender is the only rule. Believe me, surrender is the only rule. Until you surrender, you're going to go through a lot of pain if you try to fight it. And so Eckhart is talking about this, but I showed a number of other examples. People always say to me, oh, you know, when I finish this life, I'm not coming back. I'm off the wheel of karma and I'm going to go and I'm going to, you know, and just never come back. And my question is always, seriously? Are you like, you're going to go sit on a beach in Hawaii and drink Mai Tais? How many billion years do you think you can do that? And it's this whole idea that it's not about getting to the end. It's about the process. It's about playing this role. And people are always into the end game. They want to sort of just, you know, get to the end and have the thing, the good time. But the experience is what it's all about. Here's this thing about, can you be spiritually enlightened without suffering? Can you be a Super Bowl quarterback, top left? Can you be a Super Bowl quarterback and win the Super Bowl without ever being trained in sports, without ever, you know, training and exercising and stuff like that? Can you? Absolutely not. Here's one for the spies. Can you be a top-notch spy without any sort of training, without doing any sort of work? Can you be my son is a bodybuilder. Can you be a bodybuilder? Can you do that kind of stuff without lifting weights? It doesn't happen by accident. It's the stress. It is the work that makes the person elevate. And finally, can you have a PhD? Can you do a Nobel Prize if you never go to school? If your parents go to school for you and write all your exams, can you actually be a PhD and then win a Nobel Prize? It is the work, it is the pain, it is the suffering that gets you to the next level and next level. Everybody goes through all this sort of stuff. And the more you get afflicted, the more you grow. That is my main, what I maintain. This is even in evolution. This is the whole concept of survival of the fittest, that there are challenges in the universe. These things are built into the universe. There are challenges that all animals have these things. And you'd even get to the thing where I talk about the whole survival of the fittest, which was actually done by Wallace. And Wallace had this download when he had a fever. Now, he didn't ask to have a fever. He didn't ask to be very, very sick. But during that fever, that's when he got the idea of the survival of the fittest. And he wrote a letter to Darwin. And Darwin basically stole the idea and wrote a book about it and got credit for it. It was actually Alfred Wallace, who actually came up with it. And here's what he said. During one of these fits, one of these terrifying fevers, while again considering the problem of the origin of species, something led me to think of Malthus's essay on population and the positive checks, war, disease, famine, accident, etc., keeping all the populations nearly stationary. Then it occurred to me that these checks must also act upon animals and keep down the numbers. While vaguely thinking about how this would affect any species, there suddenly flashed upon me the idea of the survival of the fittest. It came during a traumatic fever situation. And he talked about going around and being bit by insects. And it was a horrible time in the 1850s doing this. That the individuals removed by these checks must be, on the whole, inferior to those that survived. Then considering the variations that continually occurring in every fresh generations of animals or plants, and the changes of the climate, of food, of enemies, always in progress, the whole method of specific modification became clear to me. And in the 2 hours of my fit, I had thought the main points of the theory. So it actually came during like an abduction experience, during a very traumatic period. That's when he came up with the idea of the idea that all animals go through this as well. I wrote 2 books on this. One is Contact Modalities. And Contact Modalities, I actually get into the idea that a lot of paranormal, or almost all paranormal stuff, has a trauma event to it. And there's, especially if you look at mediums, they all have these childhood abuse issues. And you have this idea that there's something that rips the veil, that unless you end up going through the front windshield of a car or having a, you know, a near-death experience or something like that, where you have you got to go through the trauma, the trials, or you got to work through all the problems, where you work through it and you work through it and you struggle, and then you relax the left brain, you sit down on a park bench, as would happen with the laser and with the hologram, and boom, the idea comes into your head and you get to do it. Inspired is the same thing. I go through the paranormal world of creativity. I go through all the different inventions and all the major theories that were invented, and you see this very common pattern, that it wasn't some smart guy who just figured it out. It had these bizarre things of trauma and inspiration and fevers and stuff like this, where this is where a lot of these ideas came from. So there's this sort of thing that underlines all this sort of stuff. What I basically will come down to is that the whole world is like a cinema, that we make this plan and we come in and we're on a stage. We're doing this cinema thing rather than being a victim, that we've planned all this sort of stuff. And you got to remember the Michael Newton stuff. There are 35,000 people who have been regressed who are telling this story. And they're all very consistent in the story they're telling as to what happens between lives, how we make these plans, how we come in to learn whatever we're going to learn, whether it's envy or jealousy or love or whatever lessons we come in. We don't come in randomly on a crapshoot every lifetime just to see what's going to happen. We actually have plans that we're trying to do. And according to Michael Newton, when you leave the world, they only ask you one question, and that is, how did it work out? Because you planned it. You can't blame the mother-in-law. You can't blame Hillary Clinton. You can't blame the aliens. You can't blame anybody. It's all you planned this, and you put the rocks in your path, and how did you make out? You see that one of these things with the abduction experience that I had started to see was that they do this very dramatic stuff. It's almost like a Hollywood play, and that is to get your attention. I'll talk about it in a minute. It's called the theory of wow. where we have these horrible things that are happening in the world, like this nuclear power plant in the Ukraine that comes under attack, and are they going to have to evacuate Europe? Are they going to detonate this whole plant to go up and contaminate the world? Or this girl that's shot, she's taking dog food in Ukraine, and you can't turn it off. It's the old idea that when you get these sort of plays, you can't turn the TV off. Everybody's watching, everything's just horrible, but everybody's watching. And that's this whole idea, is the idea of a play. If you go to a play and nothing's happening, you get up after 15 minutes, you walk out. So I think what a lot of the stuff that the intelligence around the UFO phenomenon is doing is they're doing this stage play thing. They're making it very dramatic. They're doing this stuff that gets your attention. And you can see that we're going into this idea that in a Hollywood thing that we're coming in, and it's actually like a play, that it's not this random materialistic religious idea that everything's happening by accident and we're biological robots in a random meaningless universe. We're starting to realize, and the more we go on, the more we realize this may actually be a simulated universe. This may actually be how this works, that we are making this play and we are like playing this whole thing. Or if you see, on the left, the idea of the holographic brain theory, this idea that we're starting to realize that Carl Pribram on the left, that the brain may be running this hologram and the world is not as physical as we think it is. It's this idea that we are creating our environment, we're developing it, and that we have a lot of control, and that we may be the ones that are putting the players all together, and there's no random stuff happening at all, that we are the ones that are running it. So you have a Hollywood thing. You're either going to run a Star Wars play where everybody's going to sit there and watch and you want to do it, or you're going to, and this is this whole idea of the God concept, that we are presenting this play for God. So we're doing this thing, and we God's going to either watch Star Wars, or he's going to sit there and whatever he wants. We don't want any trauma. We don't want any sort of stuff. We're just going to sit around the coffee table for 75 years and drink coffee. And God's got to sit there and watch this as we sit there and drink coffee. And this is the whole idea, is that if you're going to do that, people are going to get up and walk away. And this is, I believe, what the beings are doing. That's why everything is so weird. That is why they're doing all this what Jacques Vallée would call absurd stuff. Because it's when absurd, you can't turn it off. It's like the wars. You just can't turn the thing off. This is another important point that gets into this idea. And this has changed, and this is important. And because people don't really talk about experience here in material, you really don't really see a lot of discussion of this, but this is this idea about the outer body experience. You start talking to people who have had experiences, UFO experiences, and they claim they were on the ship and had in contact with the intelligence. 80% of them will say they had a near-death experience, or they've had an out-of-body experience. Yeah, they've had the out-of-body experience, no problem. I've had lots of those things. And the question starts to come down, is even the abduction experience as physical as we think it is? A lot of people will tell me when I talk to them, they say, no, I don't think it was ever abducted. They come to me in my dreams. And Bashar, the famous alien channeler, said, we come to you in your dreams because now you're in our world. And you get a lot of experiencers. When I talk to them, people will always ask the experiencer, well, did they hurt you? Did you probe? Were you scared? All this kind of stuff. And I always ask them these bizarre questions like, did you have an out of body experience? How did this thing start? And did you see dead people and all this kind of stuff? Did the aliens actually have sex organs? Did they have clothes on? All these bizarre things that when they start going, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, and then you start to realize it may actually be not as physical as we think it is, no matter how real you think it is. Because when you're in a dream, you actually think it's real, it's physical. It's not until you wake up. And that a lot of people in the near-death experience literature, out-of-body experience literature, or the abduction literature will tell you, that's the real world. You're living in a dream. The conscious world is a dream. But the important part of this slide is the whole idea that in when I talk to experiences, I ask them about this, that when you look back, when they're in this out-of-body experience state, before the aliens take them, they look back and they can see their body and they can see their head and they can therefore see their brain. Where is the consciousness? Consciousness ain't in the brain. This is clearly shows that the consciousness is the awareness and it's not in the brain. And so the question is, where is all this stuff happening? Because all the physical world, people will have to admit, is actually happening inside your head. Everything that you see, that you create, that your brain builds or whatever, is inside your head. And the out-of-body experience people, the contactee people, will start to talk to this fact that they were caught, they were separate from their body. And you start getting into this idea, this is what I'm telling you, the more we look at this, the more it's starting to unravel that this may be holographic brain, this may be simulated universe. Even Deepak Chopra says, everything is an activity inside consciousness. And I believe that is true. This is this whole idea that even when you're looking back, if you're in an out-of-body experience state, you're looking back, even you are in your consciousness. The consciousness is moving around, and you can see yourself, your physical self is inside your consciousness, which is floating around the room. And that's what Deepak Chopra says. Everything is an activity inside consciousness, mathematics, everything. It's all inside consciousness. It's all happening. And this is this idea. The more we go on, the more the UFO stories are told, the more it looks like they're talking about this holographic theory of how the world actually works. This is these beings that are going to be doing a documentary that's about to be released in the United States from Great Britain. This is two women who have contact with what they call the beings. And these beings have no faces. These are the beings that I actually asked. I said, are you actually extraterrestrial? And what they said to me is, oh, if you want us to be extraterrestrial, we can do that. We can even take you to our planet if you want. But no, we are not. We have always been here. You're the visitor. And this is this concept of why they don't have faces is because they're on this concept. It's all part of an illusion. We all decided to take part in. No one is without the other. This adventure is forever lasting. Enjoy it. Have fun. Feel the love within all things until human life changes form. And we're changing form, but it's all this illusion. It's going to this idea that the more we're going, and we can deny it now, but it's basically going to come to that the world looks less and less physical. The more we study UFO phenomena, the more we realize it may be this matrix type environment where we're just, it's like a tuning of a station. We're on the consciousness station. And what happens is the beings come in, and I always ask the question, why would beings come into your room and wake you up? This does not make any sense. Why would they wake you up and scare the living daylights out of you? If you go back to this idea of what I wrote about in Inspired and Contact Modalities, it's this idea that trauma, that this dissociation is what moves the dial of the radio and moves you into this different thing. So as soon as they come in, the person gets terrified, then the being says to them, okay, go back to sleep. The person pulls the covers over the head, goes back to sleep, and next thing the experience takes place. And it may be that they're just getting people to dissociate. They're getting people, and it's the same as in psychedelic experience where you have this dissociation thing takes place, where you have these sort of traumatic events that force you to surrender. That unless you surrender, you can't be taken. And once they scare the living daylights out of somebody in the room, well, then they say, okay, they're ready. Okay, let's take them. Here is another statement that deals with this idea about reality may not be what we think it is. Nancy Tremaine was the first person to encounter the Greys. She had her abduction experience in July of 1961, 2 months before Betty and Barney Hill. And she has since gotten all sorts of messages, all sorts of inspiration. And here's what she was told. Realities are illusions, are a part of the delusion that we have created. We are living in a delusional illusion of our own making. We are all players in this fictional theater that we perform for our creators, a muse existing for our audience. The stage is set at birth, and our performance has begun. People will say at this point, don't talk to me about anecdotal stories of what these people are saying. We need scientific method. We need to be able to measure stuff. So let's go back and let's actually take a look at René Descartes and the whole idea of the scientific method. The way the story has been twisted and told is it was all about skepticism. And I will say that René Descartes' vision of the scientific method was basically like an abduction experience today. Today we have people having abductions and channeling, all these sort of things where they were getting material from outside of the rational, conscious, analytical mind. René Descartes, for everybody that may want to check it. It's in my Inspired book. The whole idea of the scientific method came in a dream. And he was very, very clear about the fact that this was a very important dream. And he basically talked about skepticism, but it wasn't skepticism of new ideas, which is what has been turned into. It was skepticism of old ideas. He basically was in a position where he spent his life tearing down all that he had been taught. He started to doubt all the stuff he'd been taught in school and all this kind of stuff. And what has happened today is it's exactly the opposite. We have come to a position where now we're defending all the past ideas. We've turned them into creeds and things like that, where they are not to be challenged, and we challenge the new ideas. But I would contend it's like Gary Nolan from Stanford University said, when you're going to make discoveries is when you take a look at the 5% that doesn't fit on the chart, that's off the sort of the beaten path, the oddities, because it's those things that tell us that we've got something wrong. That's where we should be skeptical and of the ideas that we have, because we have this idea that everything we have is absolutely correct, and we only have to challenge the new ideas. So the idea of the scientific method has to do with challenging former ideas, and the new ideas come from the anomalies that we see, and that's what UFOs, that's what abduction experiences, out-of-body experiences, all these things should not be happening if the world is what we think it is, this materialistic, meaningless universe. The other thing that people sort of overlook is they talk about Descartes' scientific method, and they forget all the other stuff that he talked about. I cannot forget that at other times I have been deceived in sleep by similar illusions, and attentively considering those cases, I perceive so clearly that there exists no certain marks by which a state of waking can ever be distinguished from sleep. I feel greatly astonished. So he's basically saying it's impossible to tell sleep from the waking state. That is something that is coming to be talked about in out-of-body experiences, in abduction experiences, all these kind of things, near-death experiences, where the person, psychedelic experiences, where the person will say, I was in the real world. The physical conscious mind is the illusion. That is the dream. The real world is on the other side. I suppose, said Descartes, therefore, that all things I see are illusions. I believe that nothing has ever existed of everything in my lying memory tells me. I think I have no senses. I believe that the body, shape, extension, motion, locations are all functions. What is there when that can be taken as true? So he's basically this idea that what we see is the stuff we see is not as real as we think it is, and we have to question everything, but particularly the things that we assume to be correct. When it comes to Max Planck, and people will say, well, that's not what happens. But basically we have a situation where Max Planck is quoted, and he talks about the fact that he talked to his professor Joly in 1874. He sought advice, and Joly portrayed to me physics as a highly developed, almost fully mature science. Possibly in one or another nook, there could be perhaps a dust particle or a small bubble to be examined and classified. But the system as a whole stood there fairly secured, and theoretical physics approached visibility, that degree of perfection which, for example, geometry has always had for centuries. So he was basically advised not to go into physics because we got it all figured out. That's the problem we have, is we're assuming that everything that we have is correct, and the new material, because it doesn't fit into our beliefs and our religious belief about how the world is put together, then we have to question it and attack it. It is the new ideas, it's the anomalies that tell us there's something wrong with the world that we see.
All right, it's Grant Cameron back again. I just wanted to add a little piece that I had forgotten to mention in my presentation, and I think it's extremely important, and there may be some pushback on this. This is this idea that out-of-body experiences may play a large part in the abduction experience, the experience, your experience, whatever you want to call it. And people will say, well, I don't really believe that. I don't, this is too woo-woo. I would remind people that this is pretty well known, I think, in the intelligence community. It goes all the way back to Pat Price in the 1970s, where he gets this NSA facility on the East Coast, where they give him a target off the facility. He picks up on the facility. He goes into the facility, and he said, I mushed my face inside the safe. He was walking around the facility looking at it. This is top NSA facility that created this huge CIA investigation as to this leak. How did he know this? How did he know the code names? And he said that he had his face inside the safe, and he was reading the code names off the files. So he was there. This was an out-of-body state. And I would remind people that Russell Targ also talked about Hala Hamid, who is somebody they had worked for them and then started doing targeted, where he was in Brezhnev's office with her, and he was telling her where to go, and there was this staircase in behind, and she looked out over the Kremlin Square, all this kind of stuff. It's actually mentioned, the out-of-body experience stuff is mentioned in Mind Reach, which was Russell Targ and Hal Putoff's book back in the 1970s. So they knew this component about out-of-body experience. This is not woo-woo stuff. Joe McMonagle was targeted. He had gone to the Monroe Institute, which played a big part in this. Monroe Institute trained a lot of the remote viewers in this aspect of this out-of-body experience thing, where people would do the remote viewing, but they also did the out-of-body targeting, where they were out of their body and they would target. And there was differences between what they could do with remote viewing and with out-of-body experiences. And Lynn Buchanan also talks about this. And I'm sure if I were to look, I would find all sorts of remote viewers that were being used by intelligence agents that were being used out-of-body experience to target military targets and intelligence targets. So this is not as woo-woo as people think it is. It's just not talked about a lot in the UFO community. And it comes down to this bottom line that all the modalities are going to be the same thing. We're parsing all this stuff. It's all going to be tied into consciousness. So out-of-body experience, just like the idea of the simulated universe, is becoming more and more known as having its relationship to the abduction experience. I'll give one last thing and then I'll just shut this down. One of the things that you will hear in experiences with people who are on board the ship who have these experiences will say they could see in 360 degree vision. They could, and I've never heard of such a thing. If you look at the out-of-body experience literature, you'll see identical. People in out-of-body experiences claim they can see in 360 degrees. So you see these correlations between out-of-body experience and whatever the abduction experience is, and it's linked together and it has to do with consciousness. So I just wanted to add that the OBE will turn out to be a very important part of this whole mystery. It's a video game. The universe, the more we look at the universe, people can deny it still, but it will turn out to be a universe. And there's actually this whole idea, the idea that we're just these avatars, and we take a different avatar every time, and we are not the avatar. We are the person playing the avatar, and your avatar may die. It's not the end of the world. You just get another avatar and start another life. And this is what, and more and more we go along, the more it looks like this is what may be in store for us. Now, when it comes to these kids, they've actually done studies. There was one done at the University of Alberta in Canada where they looked at kids who were used to fighting off demons and evil things inside video games. And there's been studies done. Individuals with a history of gameplay experience fewer threat severity variables in their dreams. So once you have, and the concept is once you, if you've never, you believe it's a physical world and this thing pops in from nowhere and it's a demon or it's a whatever, an alien or whatever, you're absolutely terrified and you lose control. But kids in video games, what they've found is that the kid in video game, if they're confronted by this evil alien or demon or whatever, they'll say, hey, really? How many points do I get if I kill it? And they'll turn around and go after it because it's all this makeup world where to them it's this idea. And you can actually see it reduces the number of threat scenarios in their dreams by playing video games. Here's one thing I always try to point out. People are always worried in the abduction experience about me and my experience, and it was horrifying and all this sort of stuff. And I always like to point out that 330 billion cells are replaced daily in the human body. 330 billion cells die, and they are replaced by 330 billion cells of 200 different types. And it's all done without us thinking about it. 1% of our body weight. And people don't give gratitude. I mean, if they're doing gratitude meditation, they don't thank the 330 billion cells that sacrifice themselves to keep us alive and well. All we're worried about is the ego cell. It's like, I don't care about the 330 billion cells. To hell with them. Just let me know when the ego cell is in trouble. Then we're going to phone 911. And we're worried about the ego cell. We're not really worried about any death outside of ourselves or anything. We're just worried about, and that's the ego says, you got to protect me. I'm the player on the stage. This is for real. I need to be protected. And when you move into this concept of realizing you're not the actor on the stage, that's when you start to realize all these other significant things, that it's all just a sort of a video game. And going back to this Hollywood idea, it's the idea that we get stuck in this loop, like Groundhog Day, where we're not awake. We just keep playing the same thing over and over and over, and just like Groundhog Day, over and over. And then suddenly the person comes to surrender, and they sort of say, okay, whatever. And they decide they're going to help people instead of trying to save themselves. And suddenly, boom, the guy decides, oh, this is a nice place. I think I'll actually stay here. And the groundhog repetition ends. So that has deep meaning. This Groundhog Day has a real deep meaning behind it, and gets to this idea. We fight all this stuff. And we say no, the holographic universe is all going to turn out to be nonsense or whatever. And I just always remind people of Max Planck, who said a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and the new generation grows up with what it is familiar with. And that would be the idea of the video game, that if you say to kids, do you think this world is like a matrix? And they're absolutely like, you know, sure. I mean, they're not offended by the idea. The old buggers who have this, secular scientific view of the world are very threatened by this, because it means that there may be something beyond the nuts and bolts, and they spend $50,000 a year to go to MIT, and all that's going to go down the drain, and they don't want to be embarrassed. But basically, you can see the new generation coming in, and these ideas will be adopted. It's just a matter of time. Now, here's the part that I find significant about what happened with Jim. And this is where I say Jim's was maybe one of the most important experiences that ever happened. This is what Jim Semivan said. He didn't make any major changes in me like most abduction experiences do. It certainly got me talking about it. Now, this comes down to this whole idea of the theory of wow, where I say that my theory is that they're not really doing anything. They just want you to go, wow, what the hell's going on here? And they do all this weird stuff. Why do UFOs have lights on so you can see them? Why do they disappear, reappear? Why do they do all, the calculations, the crop circles, they over and over, the paranormal material, they just want to keep your interest. They don't want you walking out of the theater. They don't want you sitting there watching someone drink coffee, because you're not going to pay any attention if everybody's just sitting there drinking coffee and nobody's doing anything. So it comes to this idea of the theory of wow, which comes to Jim Semivan's experience. So Jim Semivan didn't change. Let me ask you this. If Jim Semivan had not had the experience in the 1990s, would he have tracked down Tom DeLonge and offered to help him? Would he have co-founded To the Stars Academy? Would he have spearheaded an effort starting in 2016 to bring the UFO topic into the public? Would he have helped get people in front of the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee in Congress, which then requested the Pentagon to do a UFO study and report to Congress? The answer is no and hell no. Here's what Jim said. Jim is a major player in this whole thing. If it were not for Jim Semivan, we would not have the disclosure, I maintain, we would not have the disclosure we're seeing today. This is what Jim said in this interview. A lot of us in this, these unofficial government workers, and these are people like Kit Green and people who had experiences and Nolan and all these people, decided we're going to go out. We're going to take this private. We told the highest levels of government, that's what we're going to be doing, because they can't seem to get this out. I don't know why. I've had talks with them, but they can't get it out. None of them had any issues with us doing this. They didn't have any issues with Tom DeLonge. I mean, it was just go ahead with it and keep us posted. So what you have to remember is because Jim Semivan had the experience and got hooked into the, what the hell is going on with me and started to study it and couldn't get it out of his head, he made this move to push this out. And that's what I was told in 2016. I was told high-level officials are going to come forward and they are going to say UFOs exist and they are going to force disclosure. This is exactly what Jim said that he was part of doing. And there he would not have done it if he had not been abducted. So these experiences, however terrifying and however unmeaningful they may appear at first, actually do, because they move us the same as Chris Bledsoe changed his whole life. And now he's moving on this path. And that's how they do it. They do it through weird things, through pulling people in. And it may be the soul contract that it's nothing is random, that we have all agreed. Almost like Dolores Cannon said, when they detonated the first atomic bomb, this is all the regression work she did, said that there were three waves of people that would be coming in, first, second, and third wave, and that the world would be in trouble, and these people would volunteer to come in these three waves and try to help save the world and change the consciousness of the world. And I believe Jim Semivan is one of those people, and he would not be one of those people if he had not been abducted, because 99% of people in the public don't care. You can go and do studies of this whole thing. You can go and study the top things, 100 things that people are interested in, what they would vote for and stuff like this. UFOs is never there. Everybody knows it. You go and talk to somebody, you may be excited about it because you've had an experience and you've done all this kind of stuff. And you talk to people and you can watch their eyes roll back in their head. Nobody cares. This is something that unless you're motivated, unless you've had an experience, Jim Semivan would be like those 99% of people who wouldn't care, wouldn't want to hear about it. Who cares about UFOs, this sort of thing? It's only when you've had the experience, when you've been motivated, when you've been drawn into this thing and it's bizarre and you can't get out of your head, that you start to move. And that's why I believe we have disclosure, because in the large part, Jim Semivan and others had these experiences. And this is this whole thing, Gillibrand's groundbreaking unidentified aerial phenomena amendment. And I would just point out to people that Gillibrand, for people who really don't know, actually has Hillary Clinton's seat. When Hillary Clinton went to Secretary of State, she was actually appointed to Hillary's seat in Congress, and she's friends with John Podesta. John Podesta was giving money to her campaigns, and so you've got to keep that in mind as to why is Gillibrand doing what she's doing. So I would say, here's the history. I would say that in history, Jim Semivan will not go down as a high-level CIA official for any of the work he did in the CIA. He will be famous because of his UFO experience, because we'll all agree that once you understand the UFO thing, you can understand that the world is not the place we think it is. The whole world is going to change, and it has to be moved by people who change the paradigm. And Jim is one of the guys that's helping change the paradigm. That's what he'll become famous for, is this idea that he helped bring disclosure. That's it. Thanks for listening. And hopefully it gave you some insight into what may be going on.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.